Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's the My First Gig Podcast. Whoa. Sharing stories of first gigs and shows. Comedians sharing their memories. The fun and entertaining, exciting and crazy. With Dwayne Dugan as your host. It's the My First Gig Podcast. Here we go.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Hello and welcome to the My First Gig Podcast. You're here. You're actually here. You're listening. There was a while there when I didn't think you were going to turn up. I was kind of just sitting in this room on my own and wondering where you were going to be. Welcome. My name is Dwayne Dugan. I'm coming to you from a surprisingly sunny Dublin, Ireland. I am a comedian. I'm a host. Am I now a podcaster? Can I call myself a podcaster before the episode's even begun? I've done it. World famous, world traveled podcaster. You may know me from such podcasts as My First Gig. That's about it. Yeah, delighted that you're here, that you're listening. It's been a long time coming. 3 years in the making, in fact. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wow, 3 years. Dwayne, you've been building this for 3 years. This is surely going to be the greatest podcast of all time. And look, it might be. If you think that, fair play to you. I really hope you do, to be honest. But no, it's just been a lot of stop starts, waiting for the time to be right, waiting for the perfect storm of something to release it. I just thought, look, it's a new year, let's get it out there. There's some great interviews over the next series with some fantastic comedians, with some, you know, really interesting and funny stories about their first gig. And it was a shame sitting on my hard drive. So here we are, my first gig is finally here. It's self-explanatory, my first gig. I just thought, I started this as a regular podcast, you know, fortunately doing what we do, whether it be at like festivals or touring comedians or whatever happens, you come across like just people with interesting stories to tell. And I started sitting down with a few of them and just talking to them. And I bored myself to death asking the same old questions. I wanted to come up with a nice concept. And at the time, the comedy club that I run is called Cherry Comedy in Dublin. If you're Irish, hopefully you've heard of it. Come on down. We used to have new acts on, brand new act, like doing their first ever set every single week. So I thought, you know, while we're promoting first ever gigs, let's talk to established comedians about their first ever gig. So that's kind of just where the idea was born. So here we go, let's go. It's series 1, episode 1 with the wonderful James Acaster. We recorded this at the Kilkenny Cat Laughs Comedy Festival in the summer of 2018, just maybe about 2 months after the release of his Netflix specials, the Repertoire series. So, you know, there was already a buzz about James and it's only gotten bigger since. So I must warn you, you may hear some staff in the background, because as I said, we recorded this at the Cat Laughs, which is basically, Kilkenny is a street, one street that crosses a stream and somehow turns into a comedy festival every June bank holiday weekend. It's an amazing festival. I definitely recommend you go check it out. The lineups every year are fantastic. But finding the quiet corner, you know, is a tricky thing. So we managed to record in the venue where James was performing in that evening. However, there was one staff member who had some very important work to do. Now, you might not spot it, but, you know, those eagle eyes? I don't know, who cares? Those with the perky ears may hear it if you listen very closely, but try not to let that get in your way of what is a fantastic chat. But yeah, let's get into it. Hope you enjoy the chat, guys. And look, you know, need your help getting this off the ground. So if you like it, tell your friends, share it, do whatever you need to do. But right now, sit back, relax, and enjoy my first gig with James Acaster.
I know, there's a few festivals that I do each year that are in little places like this.
Yeah?
Yeah, and it's just, you put a bunch of good comics in a really picturesque, beautiful small town or whatever, then it kind of does well, I think. I think it's quite, it's a recipe that a lot of people haven't tapped into, that like, it's just, yeah, like most comics will do most gigs. And so if you've just got a nice, really beautiful place to live in for a few days, they'll all go there. And then the locals will be like, oh, this is great, we've got good comedy here, and they'll go and see it. And then people who are huge comedy fans will go to the first one because they'll travel to see all these great comics in a really beautiful village or town. And then it builds because then people just talk about it. If anything, it's how to keep it under control so it doesn't get, you know, too busy.
You came to Ireland last year. You did a few shows in Dublin.
Yep.
How did you find gigging in Ireland compared to, say, other places outside of the UK?
Well, it depends, really, because, like, you know, it's like, Dublin, I've always had a nice time in, and always find the crowds really friendly, and they seem to watch a lot of comedy and up for it. And there's been other places in Ireland that I've been to and never had a good gig there, and it's been hard. And I'll continue to go back and try again, but like, you know, it hasn't worked out for me yet. And there's no kind of, yeah, I couldn't, like, I wouldn't know why. Also, there's loads of places all around the UK that, you know, even in the same cities or towns where you go, I do well at that venue and not at that one. And it's hard to know, really.
So when you released the four specials earlier this year, what was that like? Because obviously some of those shows were several years old. You've been kind of working on them for a while, and it all kind of concluded then with the releasing, 4 hours in one day, just out there.
Yeah.
Was that a strange feeling, just, you know, putting it all out at once?
It was a relief.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, I had it in my head for a long time and been planning it for a long time. And, you know, the last year of my life had been just touring those shows and doing them relentlessly. Those shows I did in Dublin were for the record, part of that tour. And so, like, yeah, when really having them all go out was just like, oh, it's done now. Like, you kind of don't feel like it's definitely going to be on Netflix until it goes on Netflix.
Sure.
Because, you know, that was the dream, to get it on Netflix, and so until it goes on there, you don't feel like it's going to be. Are you worried about the clanging? I mean, there's no way we'd be able to tell them to not do that. We'd be given quite the, oh, I'm sorry, you're doing a radio thing, are you? Be in big trouble. In fact, I think that guy kind of saw us doing this and immediately started. What he's doing, for the listener, is just rearranging bottles in the most unnecessary task I've ever seen a barman have to, like, he is just swapping bottles around. He's loving it.
So when you have like 4 hours like that, that you, like, you know, so the first of the shows, when would that have started? Because obviously the show would have been probably about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, maybe.
Well, yeah, the first show in the four that is like the first one that you watch is it was 2014, and then the next show is 2015, and the next show is 2016. But then the fourth show is material from 2011, 2012, and 2013. So, like, and it's like a best of those three different shows. So, yeah, the oldest, and even then, I think I threw some older jokes in. So, I think the oldest joke in all of them is in the, it is in the last show about Botox and your eyebrows sliding round to the side of your face. And that joke was like pre my first ever Edinburgh show. That was like probably 2009 or something.
So gone proper,
and,
Yeah.
And I'd written it, and I did it on Russell Howard's Good News, and then never did it again because I thought, well, that's burnt now because everyone's seen it. And then, and then you realise, no, everyone has not seen it. You did it on Russell Howard's Good News, and some people have seen it, but most people have not heard that joke.
Do you feel that kind of, that whole idea of that's burnt now, the fact that there's all of these out under your name, that's, I guess, you know, you've got to let all of that go now?
Yeah, but not because it's out there, because I don't want to do it anymore.
Sure.
Okay. So, like, I think it's like, I want to move on and move forward as a comic and get better. And so I'm longing to do new stuff, so I'm not doing any of that stuff. And sometimes people will ask for it. There's one routine that where I sing a football chant for a long time, and people request that at gigs, and I think it's got round now that I say no, because some people were saying, actually just last night here, I wanted to request that song, but I'm told you don't do it. I just like, I'd be like, you know, I used to really scratch my head at, like, why are people behaving like this at comedy shows, and then I've just realised it's just not
It's not like singing along with like a band kind of a thing, is it, I guess?
But still seeing their favourite bit. I like seeing that bit. I want to see that bit. And they don't know that when you do the bit they've requested, it's not going to be fun for them.
Sure.
They don't think that. Really what they want to do is go home and watch it again on TV, and they should do that. And I thoroughly encourage them to, like, yeah, do that over and over again. But like, they go, I want to see it live. And then they're like, well, why isn't this as good? Or they kind of like are just like, weirdly laugh along with it. It's a comfort thing. It's not really what you're after. I think, yeah, if you do the same thing over and over again and they know what you're going to do, I don't think they're going to come back and see you necessarily for that reason. I don't know.
Do you have any idea what your first memory of comedy is?
Yeah, I think, well, it's comedy because my first memory of stand-up comedy was seeing a Lee Evans video when I was probably 14 or something like that, and it being like a stand-up, or what I would now refer to as alternative stand-up, you know, that kind of like, at the time it was pretty alternative comedy. And like seeing something to observational comedy and thinking, I don't know how like this person knows these things about my life and this is amazing that, you know, I do that. I thought I was the only one and everyone's laughing at it. He's summed it up so well. It was just amazing. It was magical. And I watched that video over and over again. But like, in terms of just getting into comedy, I think I was raised going to church. And there was like, there'd be a sketch every week, a little comedy sketch.
In church?
Yeah, that people would do. Like, there's this guy called Mark, who was funny. So he would kind of either do a sketch with him in it or with someone else in it in order to teach like some lesson about Christianity, but in a fun way.
Yeah.
I just loved the sketches. I thought it was so funny and I really wanted to be in a sketch. And I thought that was my favourite part of church each week, was that and the music. So the band playing is a kind of like, it's like a, it wasn't like a old like traditional church. It was like a in a community centre. And,
sure, yeah.
You know, the band were like a rock band and stuff.
I can't imagine it, yeah, happening at an altar somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. But like, I would really want to be in the band and play the music, and I really want to be in the sketches and do the comedy.
So that probably that would kind of count as seeing comedy live in person. But do you remember the first time? Seen stand-up live? Was it before, like long before you'd started this, long before you wanted to do it?
There was a guy who, and this probably wasn't stand-up necessarily, but he was, there was like a variety show at our local village, the village my parents lived in. So that was when I was, I don't know, I was probably still in secondary school, like 11 or 12. And this guy who just had a red jacket on was going on in between the acts and doing the MC's job, basically, but like doing jokes and routines. He's just an old boy who lived in the village. And looking back, some of his jokes were really racist and they weren't actually okay. And but it was just seeing someone just so relaxed and making everyone laugh. And I think he referred to himself as he looked like a fugitive from Butlins because he had a red coat on. And I actually got to that because I knew that people in Butlins wore red coats. I was like, oh, this is great. And but like first time going to see stand-up, I had to pinpoint the very first time. It started being... there was like comedy nights in Kettering where I lived. And it's hard to know if the first night, the time that I saw stand-up was going to watch one of those gigs where it was like a mixed bill of acts who weren't like on TV or anything like that. And it was like, or if the first time I went to see comedy was when I went to see Lee Evans at the Nottingham Trent Arena. I don't know if that was the first time or not.
Sure.
But I remember that gig feeling quite weird because it was an arena gig and I felt really far away from him and not involved with it and felt like, actually, this isn't very good because I feel like I'm watching a little tiny man in the distance telling jokes and I don't feel like anyone around me is...
So you probably would have been closer watching it on the telly, like.
Yeah, yeah. And it just didn't feel great. And it took ages to get in there, ages to get out, ages to find the car to drive out. And you're going, oh, what's the point of any of that? Like... I'd rather have been in a small room watching him, you know. But like, yeah. And then I went to a pub in Kettering that started putting on gigs, and called the Rising Sun, although it changed the name to the Sun and to Bar Sun and everything else that had Sun in it. But like, I think there's a guy called Kevin McCarron would MC it. It was a Laughing Horse gig that was in Kettering, and Laughing Horse are mainly known for doing gigs in London, and they'd spread out a bit. And Kevin McCarron, who's like an Australian comic, would MC it. And I think the first one I went to was a new act competition, and so I couldn't name you any of the acts who were on it, but they all did like 5 minutes each, and then at the end someone got through to the semi-final or something like that. But like, I remember going to watch that and kind of seeing some people who did well, some people who didn't, some audience members heckling, you know, and having to be dealt with and stuff like that. And yeah, it's just quite a fun, I wouldn't say like I love it, didn't blow my, I wasn't like, this is amazing, because I was already into, I still thought stand-up is what I watch on TV, and it's those kind of, and I hadn't yet seen the comics who really inspired me to start doing stand-up, who were like people like Josie Long and Ross Noble and Eddie Izzard and people like that, who were speaking about whatever they wanted and being really creative with it. And I was like, oh, you can do whatever you want with comedy, it's not just observational stuff.
So was it discovering that kind of gave you the itch to actually go and try
it? Yeah, because I was like, oh, it's like any other creative like performance or whatever, is that you can do what you want. And it's just with comedy, you kind of have to make them laugh. But then even now, I think, well, I don't think that's even strictly true. But like, back then I was like, yeah, I was like, okay, I can talk about a story of like a silly little thing that just happened to me. It doesn't have to be that everyone relates to it. And I can do a weird bit that is just like surreal, and that's comedy as well. And comedy isn't just, you know, when you're walking down the street and someone's walking the same way and you try and both move in the same direction to get past each other. Yeah, that's what I thought you had to do. I was like, how am I going to... It just seemed impossible to do those kind of observations at the time.
So what, or where and when did you have your first gig, and how did they come about then? Did you kind of seek out where would take new acts, or did you seek out people who were doing it, how to join in?
It's kind of accidental. It was I was in a band. So I left school when I was 17. I stayed on for 1 year as sixth form because my dad just wanted me to. He said, stay on for 1 year. If you don't like it, you can leave. But he thought I would carry on, do 2 years anyway, because you get to the end of the first year, you thought I may as well. And I just got to the end of the first year and went, I kept at my end of the bargain, and I'm leaving school now. And then I always wanted to be in bands with my friends. And I formed a band with some friends of mine. I was playing music all the time. But I had a part-time job in a kitchen, so I had loads of free time on my hands. And then I crashed my car when I was 18, and it was just a point in the car crash where my car was balancing on two wheels, and it could have rolled, but it didn't roll. But it really hit me hard the next day that if it had rolled, I would have died, and I got really scared about that. And I just thought about death for 6 months, and that's all I thought about. And I kind of, then coming out of that, I got very weird about having free time and feeling like I shouldn't be wasting any of my time. I should be doing stuff. And so I tried to do things that were more like just life goals and ticking things off in some sort of bucket list. And like, I did a skydive at one point. And another thing was like, do more volunteer work and do something good. And so I went to the volunteer bureau where someone called Katie Rock was working, who I went to school with. And weirdly, even though like I only really knew her properly for this small part of my life, I went to school with her, but then she left our school when she was 13, and like I didn't see her again until like, yeah, she was working the volunteer bureau. So that really my only relationship with Katie is this very small window, and yet I owe her quite a lot, really. But she sent me to an old lady's house to paint a kitchen for volunteer work. I did an awful job. I tried to do a good job, but did quite a bad job. And afterwards, they were like, thank you for doing that, and can we do anything for you in return? And I was like, nope, because like I didn't feel like I'd done a good enough job in that kitchen. I didn't feel like I deserved a reward. And they said, honestly, just is there like something you'd like to do, maybe an experience you'd like to have, or a goal, something you'd like to achieve or try out? And one of the other things I'd written down on my list of things to do, on the kind of bucket list, was to try stand-up comedy. And I said to them, I'd like to try stand-up comedy. And I only said it because I thought they couldn't do it, because they were a volunteer bureau in Kettering. It wasn't like me saying, oh, I'd like to go, you know, on a boat or something, and they could have hooked that up somehow and found someone who knows someone who works in a park or whatever. Like, this was like, they can't sort it out, and I know they can't sort it out. And they said they can't. They said, oh, we don't do that. I was like, oh, okay, well, see you later. And that was it. And then, like, within a week, they phoned me up, and they were like, coincidentally, a man has just come in and asked us if we would help him run a stand-up comedy workshop, so we've put your name down for it, and it starts on this day, and there's 9 sessions, and then you do a gig at the end. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. And then like I went It was every Thursday for 9 weeks, and I turned up on the first day, and it was me and two other people, and who showed up, and that was it. And this guy who was running it, and this guy who was running it had done a handful of open mic gigs in London and quit. He was not a stand-up comedian. He was a friend of someone who worked at the bureau, at a volunteer bureau, and he wanted some money. Although, also, I owe this guy a lot. And I always speak of him. When I speak of him, I always feel like a bit mean because I sound really dismissive. But I think that his approach was really great. And I think that it really helped me. And it was the perfect approach for people doing stand-up. And it was that he just turned up and all he would do was say, you basically had to go away and write 10 minutes of material and come back the next week and perform 10 minutes of stand-up to just him and the other two, you know, students, I guess. And we didn't know at the time that that's a lot of material to write in a week. We didn't know that. We just were like, because it seemed like nothing, actually. I was feeling, you know, 10 minutes is nothing. And, like, you know, these stand-up DVDs I watch, you know, they're doing an hour or so, more than an hour. So, like, he's only asked me to do 10 minutes. So you go away and do 10, you come back and perform it to him and the others, and they would just say if it was good or not. He wouldn't give you any tips. He wouldn't say, with that bit, you should try and do this, or maybe, you know, that doesn't suit your voice, do this a bit more. He was just going, that was shit, or that was really funny, well done. And that was it. And he'd say what bits were good and what bits were bad, and then you'd sit down, and then the next person would get up, and you'd all critique the same thing and just say, that was good, that was bad, that was it, that was funny, that was not funny. And that was 9 weeks. Like, 1 week we went to London to watch a comedy show, but really it was so that he could meet up with a friend and discuss some dodgy deals while we watched a comedy gig. And then at the end of it, we did this gig, which was at the Rising Sun, Bar Sun, whatever it was called at the time. And Nick Coppin was emceeing it. He's a London comic. I forget, because there was two gigs that got put on. I know my second gig was also in the same venue with the same compere. So I forget who was the headliner for the first one, but I think it was Mike Belgrave. And me and the other two guys were in the middle. There was an opening act who may have been... It wasn't John Smith, because John Smith was the second one, but he's a funny deadpan comic from the Northeast. But I didn't intend to do stand-up. I wasn't pursuing it as a thing. I was in a band. That was what I was going to do. This was just an experience, like jumping out of a plane was.
Chicken in the box, kind of.
Yeah, I was just going to get up and do stand-up. I was really nervous about it and really kind of like shitting it. But like, I pretended all day like it wasn't happening. I pretended, I'm not doing anything. I'm just going to go to a comedy gig to convince myself and not be scared all day. And then he said my name and I just got up and did it. And they was a very friendly, supportive audience because they all knew it was my first gig. But yeah, it was totally not me going, right, I'm going to do stand-up comedy. I'm going to be a comedian. And then going out and looking for gigs or going out and looking for a proper stand-up comedy course that could teach me the ropes and give me the confidence to get on stage. It was this really like... just ramshackled, just a guy, just basically kind of doing 9 gigs or whatever to 3 people every week of new material, and really just getting told funny or not funny, and then doing a gig at the end of it. But I kind of think that's a great way to... We didn't have to pay for it. It was free. And it was just him sitting... And he would have a load of beers next to him, and he'd be drinking and we wouldn't be drinking, and that was it. That was like the thing every week. And I actually think just the very act of just getting up and doing it and being told if you're funny or not,
and then going home and writing every week, I guess, as well, like,
yeah and that was enough. Like, and then it's like, okay, now I can do a gig. And it wasn't until like I probably then did a gig once every 4 months for 2 or 3 years, and then when I was 23 I started stand-up, like, my band had split up, and I was like, right, I'm going to do stand-up comedy now. And then I was way more precious about what I said on stage. It wasn't just like, because yeah, before I was fine with like, whatever, I was just fucking around and I'll do stuff that is a bit hack or whatever, you know. I'll kind of, you know, fake improvise and things like that when I know I'm kind of cheating the audience a little bit, being a bit cheeky, because it's not really improv, but I don't care, this is not my art. Music is, you know. And then, as soon as I was like, I'm going to be a stand-up, it was like, right, I'm going to just write stuff that I would want to see on stage. But I had no idea how to do it, how to do that stuff. The stuff that I would actually want to watch was way beyond me and my skill set. And I was also getting, like, my first load of gigs I got in London were not bad gigs for an open micer, because I'd done enough, I'd done these little spots elsewhere where I'd been the middle act, when there was like two professional acts either side of me, back when I didn't care, and I'd done well because I didn't care. And so I had someone to vouch for me. I could say, like, oh, such and such saw me at a gig and they can vouch. So I'd get on this quite, you know, a new act night that was like not, you know, 20 acts doing 5 minutes each. I'd go get the middle spot of a club gig, but I totally wasn't ready for it and couldn't do it. And I would just bomb and play to nothing. And then I had to really like backtrack and go back to square one and go, no, you've actually got to start doing the really shit gigs and do those properly.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As far as actually starting out, though, obviously you can't recommend to people to nearly tip their car and have somebody randomly walk into a volunteer centre.
Sure.
But especially this festival, a lot of the people have said that they've done, in some form or another, a workshop.
Yeah.
That obviously, you know, that takes care of the writing and takes care of that first gig.
Mm.
Would you recommend going that avenue for people, do you think?
Well, I've never done a proper workshop, so I don't know. Because my one was literally...
Of sorts, anyway.
Yeah. So, like, I would recommend what I did, but I don't think it exists anywhere else. Like, so, like, you could start it with your friends, maybe. If you know a bunch of other friends who want to do stand-up, like, I would actually recommend it. If there's, like, four of you or three of you, or even two of you, I don't know. Just, like, literally have a thing with each other where, like, okay... We'll both write 10 minutes a week, we'll perform it for each other, and we'll give honest feedback, and we won't get our feelings hurt. You're not allowed to like throw a strop and fall out of each other, and do that, and then go, right, and we'll do 10 weeks, and then we have to do it. So we'll book a gig now that's like 11 weeks away, and then we're going to do these. And then and like, I'd recommend that, because that's what I did. And so, like, I don't know, like, I sometimes think that it took me longer to learn some things because I didn't go to a workshop. So, because I didn't do a proper workshop and get given like notes and stuff, actually writing punchlines and working on your persona and stuff like that were all things that I had to figure out myself. But then I feel like, because I figured out, with me anyway, just as an individual, if I figure something out myself, I learn it properly because I really understand it more. Whereas when I get taught stuff in theory by other people, I'm not always as good at understanding it afterwards and having a proper grasp on it. I know it in theory, but I don't understand it. And with stand-up, I was like more than happy to just keep on failing over and over again until I learned, okay, this is what works for you and this is actually how to do this. But then I think from what I gather from stand-up workshops and courses, the proper courses are that, you know, you get the confidence to go on stage, but some of the courses can result in all the acts coming out the same with very similar voices. There's one course in particular where you can tell if someone's been on that course when you see a new act.
Sure,
you go,
yeah,
they've done that course because they're speaking in these speech patterns and these rhythms, and they're not themselves yet.
It's, yeah, it would generally be like 10 people coming out with one person's opinion, I guess.
Yeah.
It's
not even an opinion, it's more delivery. And you go, that delivery is how they're told to do it on that course. However, that same course that I'm referring to has come out with at least, off the top of my head, three top acts in stand-up who like are very successful comedians. So it's not like, you know, and they've got their own individual voices and they're brilliant. So it's not like that's the blanket rule. So I think whatever you do, whatever your start in stand-up, you can overthink it, I think. But like really, it's all about you following your instincts and just doing it and getting on with it. So whether your way of starting it is you just get on stage one night and just try some stuff you've never said to anyone before, or you get together with a friend every week and workshop stuff and then you do it, or you go on a course and properly do it. Either way, it's got to be that the thing that's going to guide you through being a stand-up is yourself and your own instincts and going, oh, I should take things in this direction, I should do this. And so that's just the push at the start. The course or whatever it is just a little push onto stage to begin with. And which is always the hardest bit, you know, it's like writers always say the hardest bit of writing is starting and sitting down at the computer and actually starting to write. And once you're in the flow of it, it's like, okay, cool. And then you can write a whole pile of like absolute bullshit for your first draft, but you've got something now that you can now chip away at and, you know, hone into something good. And the main thing with stand-up is that it's always a huge lump of shit and you're chiseling away and trying to make a sculpture out of it that's nice. And you've always, but it's a never ending, you know, just when you finish the sculpture, something like shit grows somewhere else. You go, oh, I can't start again, or we have to start on another lump of shit. But like, it's never, comedy is all falling on your face and failing over and over again in order to achieve something that is, this is what I wanted it to be. You know, those stand-up specials were probably, you know, 8 years of work, 7 years, whatever it was, and all started off rubbish and not working, and then, like, worked, and then stopped working, and then I had to fix them, and then, you know, and then filming them was like, you know, it's like film them now while they're still working, because they won't work, you know, in another month's time, they might not work again. And it's just getting them there and going, okay, cool, I somehow captured them, I got what I wanted, and that's what I was trying to do. And now on to the next show, and that's like, you know, I'm doing the next show now, and some nights I enjoy it, and some nights I'm like, this makes no sense, this isn't working, and that'll never go away. So I think people often are put off starting in stand-up because they're like, I'm not going to be funny, it's not going to be good, and they're so worried about it being good. And the whole point is that it's not good for so much of the time, and then you occasionally just get those glimpses of what you wanted, and you know, and you can get it to that. But so much of it is like, you're not meant to be parading around the stage with your arms outstretched while everyone stamps their feet and claps their hands and cheers and you're the best.
Sure.
And
yeah, it's work, obviously.
Yeah, it's work, but it's also, you're the fool, and you're not this kind of like, you're not the jock, you're the geek in school. You're the people that, which is the person that people can actually relate to. No one relates to the jock, but everyone can relate to the insecure, you know, geek who gets pushed around a bit and, you know, and doesn't quite know, you know, is quite unsure of things, are trying to find their way. So, like, you know, it's not about being this, like, alpha male character, which I think everyone thinks it is. And you're not, you don't have to be this perfect person before going into it, this perfect for stand-up, this confident, you know. I think that's what the courses give you a lot of the time, is the confidence to get on stage. But
The Kettering Sun, many yeah. names. You're there, about to go on stage, the MC's gone up, you know you're next. Do you remember what you're feeling?
It was a scramble of like incoherent thoughts, and then I remember him saying my name, and then as I walked to the stage thinking to myself, what are you doing? And literally thinking, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? There's no one made you put yourself through this. And also you had to walk, basically the stage was next to the front door of the pub, the entrance to the pub. So you had to walk towards the entrance of the pub, and I considered just walking out of the door, which I now think would have been very funny. But I didn't consider doing it for a joke. I considered just like, you can just fucking escape now. And actually, that would have been, if I'd done that, not only would it, I think the crowd have thought it was funny, but also I would have found my comedy voice a lot quicker. I've been like, oh yeah, just do the instinct stuff and just go for that. But like, I didn't do that. I went straight on stage. But like, I was definitely, my thoughts were, why are you putting yourself through this and why you're doing this.
Do you remember your first joke?
Yeah, I did some fake improv about a... and actually, maybe this is, in a way, the earliest joke that made it into the stand-up special, but very convoluted way. So the mic stand... everyone was going up and, you know, take the mic out of the stand and move the stand to the side and then do your set. And I had planned... I hadn't planned to do it. I thought maybe I'd do it. And then I decided to, because I didn't really have an opener. So I just put all the different to the mic out the stand and I moved the stand to the side. And I said, I looked at it and I thought, oh, actually, I don't think it's very good there. And then I moved it to the other side of the stage. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure about that. And there was a sofa on the stage. And so then I moved the sofa around and then I adjusted the mic again. And I asked the audience if anyone knows anything about feng shui. And it was like a... like I was rearranging the furniture and the stuff on stage to, so I had the right chi in the room for my show, for my set that I was about to do. And
so I think a version of that ended up on the specials.
Yeah, so yeah. At the end of the second show is me taking the stuff apart. And the reason initially in that show that I was taking the stuff apart was the feng shui. So I bought that joke back in previews and work in progress shows for that second show, and I was doing it as like I'd set it up at the start that there's this feng shui thing, and then I would at the end be moving stuff around and not sure about it. But like I found that the feng shui stuff was an over explanation of why I was moving stuff around, and actually one night I just forgot to do the feng shui stuff and then at the end did all the moving stuff around, and it was funnier that I was doing it without any explanation and that I was just frustrated with the stage. And I'm kind of happy that it gets that, you know, the audience enjoy it more and it's more fun, but that I do know why my character's doing it. That whole show is about doubt and uncertainty and believing in stuff that you're not sure is true, and feng shui is definitely one of those things. And the fact that when I start to get frustrated in the show, I'm trying to rearrange the stuff on stage so I can get the right chi so that I feel more calm, and I can't do it and I get frustrated and take everything apart. So the fact that I know that's why I'm doing it is enough for me. And if I have to explain it to them and that sucks the energy out of the show, I'd rather not do that. So, but that came from my, yeah, that's the first ever joke I did on stage. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's still made it, or a version of it.
Yeah.
So, so you say that, like, you know, you still get to laugh when you forgot that line. So do you think it's like, it's possible that to over-explain something can kill a joke or kill a bit?
If you over-explain it, yeah, if it's not funny.
I guess taking the audience's intelligence for granted.
Yeah,
as well.
Or if you kind of confuse them by it. I think I was just confusing them. It was an extra thing of like, oh, hold on, so he's doing this because it's feng shui and because he's doing that. So it was like, oh, this is why he's doing it and blah, blah, blah. Whereas actually, just the fact that I was clearly getting wound up, and part of me getting wound up was me moving stuff around the stage erratically, was funny enough about the character. Like, that's the persona and we don't need to know why he's doing it, but they kind of get the feeling of it's because it's clearly some anxiety manifesting itself, and so that's funny rather than kind of doing a bit at the start. Because also I at the start of the show try and explain the feng shui stuff, and it was just too much of a convoluted beginning, you know. It didn't really make sense to start the show with this bit that wasn't the funniest bit in the show, and you know, and yeah, it wouldn't really, and it would seem kind of forced and false. And I just had to go, right, do you know what, I'd rather get the laughs, and if anyone ever kind of challenges me on it and goes, why are you doing that stuff, I'll have an answer for it. But like, otherwise it's funny without it, it makes sense without it. And you just got to kind of, sometimes even if something really means something to you, I really love the phrase kill your babies when it comes to editing stuff. And like, even if you really love a bit and it means a lot to you, or even if a bit's really working but it doesn't mean that much to you, taking those bits out and being like, no, even though this is something that works or this is something that means a lot to me, it doesn't work in the context of the show, I'll probably find a home for it some other time. I'll take it out for now and the show will be better off for it. So, you know, you can over-explain stuff, but some stuff's good explained and some stuff isn't.
What changed? I know you said that you were in the band and then the band stopped, but was that the main reason that gave you kind of the kick to go, right, this is, I'm doing this now?
Not really, because like, I thought I'm doing this, but not I'm doing this as this is going to be my thing. I was like, I've got no qualifications. I live with my parents and work part-time in a kitchen, and I now don't have a band, and I'm a drummer, and starting up a new band is going to be really difficult, especially living in a small town. You know, like, I met all the musicians I was going to meet, and I just didn't know what to do. I had nothing to do, and I'd done those stand-up gigs and enjoyed them, and so I just was like, I'm going to do these until I figure out what I want to do, because I can't stay at home. Like, I was, I really love my friends back in Kettering, but I was hanging out with the same people, and we were just doing the same things. We were just all watching DVDs that we'd already watched before every night around each other's houses, and we'd run out of like stuff to talk about because we weren't, you know, we just saw each other all the time. I thought, these people are going to be like, I'm not going to lose their friendships if I'm not around. So, like, and also some of them were getting busy. I was just like, I got to go out and do something. So I just chose to do stand up as a way of filling my evenings, and I thought it won't be what I end up doing, because at that time as well, I think I was in the last wave of comics before stand-up was seen as a job again. Like, it wasn't like all the people that I was on the open mic circuit with, we didn't think this was, will be our living and we will make money from it. We were just like a bunch of people who had failed at other things or felt a bit lost. And which is what was quite romantic about the open mic circuit, and what I quite liked is we're a bunch of like this rogues gallery lineup every night of like people who were all different stages in their lives and different things have kind of not worked out, and then we were doing stand up as a way of kind of like figuring those problems out in a way, and so I wasn't thinking this will be my job, and then because I was a very motivated person, and I like, what I found frustrating about being in bands was that I just wanted to write new songs every day and do gigs every night. And I never found other people who wanted to write new songs every day with me. My friend Graham, who I was in the final band with, was more like that and did love writing new stuff all the time. And that band was different, but like, I didn't think I was going to find that again. So, but like, and also in terms of getting gigs, there wasn't enough music gigs to get a gig every night, and it was just frustrating. But then with stand-up, there is more than enough gigs for everyone who wants to do comedy to do a gig every night on the open mic circuit in London, and you can write new stuff every day and do it that very night. And so for someone who wants to do that kind of stuff creatively, it was just like, okay, great, I can scratch that itch really easily. So it's just a good environment for someone who has that kind of drive. And so for the first year and a half, I didn't really enjoy stand-up because I didn't consistently enjoy it, because I felt like a fish out of water. I felt like with music, I really knew what I was doing, even though we weren't successful at all, and even though we didn't really have any fans. I was like, I know how to write the songs I want to write. I know how to execute them properly and to perform them on stage. And then with comedy, I was like, I don't know how to write the kind of jokes I want to write. I don't know how to execute them. I don't know how to perform them. And it was really quite a horrible experience, because I just felt suddenly like I didn't know what I was doing, and that I was really shit at something. I didn't think I would watch what I was doing, which is like, I felt like I would watch and listen. I thought I'd listen to the music I was making. I didn't think I would watch and enjoy the comedy I was doing. So I was like, this isn't going to be my job. And then a year and a half in, I was like, okay, I do want to do this for a living now. And it just took that long for me to find a voice in comedy that I liked, that suited me, some material that I liked doing that I would have watched. And again, like, you know, it was like unplanned how I got into doing those gigs, like doing that material. It was like did a gig at noon in Edinburgh Festival where I did a guest spot for someone and no audience showed up. So I did a new routine to two other comics, and they just told me to do that routine at every gig. And it became my first routine that worked, but, you know, I actually didn't want to do that gig to two comedians. I was going to just say no to them and did it to be polite. And it's actually a really good, you know, there are loads of open, one bit of advice I would give open spots is that when you start off as an open spot, there are a lot of people who will say no to the things that look like they're going to make a fool of them. I won't do a gig to two other comics in a room at midday in Edinburgh. I won't travel all that way To do a gig for no money and basically make a loss on the train fare. And and people will say no to a lot of that stuff. And actually, when you're an open spot, I found a lot of the times when I said yes to that kind of stuff, I would end up getting something out of it. And it would be rewarding and fruitful. And as long as you are taking risks every time you go on stage in the form of trying out new stuff, you know, just doing anything that will find your voice. So trying out new material, trying out a new delivery, trying out a new persona, image, whatever it is. If you're just trying out every single idea you've got and being as creative as possible and doing every single shit gig and gig that sounds like it's impossible, then you will find what it is that will make you funnier than everybody else. In terms of funnier at that one, at that type of comedy. So you're funny. You're funniest at this, and no one else is as funny as that at you because you're you, and that's everyone in the world. I believe that. I believe that everybody, if they wanted to, could find a way that they are funnier than anybody else because you are, unique in the least naive sense. I can use that. Like, you know, we're all similar to each other, all people, all predictable, but like, you know, there is something about you that is a certain combination of ingredients that makes you you, and it's quite distinctive. And as soon as you learn to tap into that, and that's where your humor comes from, no one else can quite touch that without looking like a fraud and without looking disingenuous. So like, that's the thing as an open spot. It's just like, just find that, you focus on finding that and not going down the same path everyone else is going down that looks like, oh, that's what I should be doing, that's what comedians are supposed to do. And even listening to like stuff like this or Comedian's Comedian or stuff like that and going like, oh, there's probably answers here. I mean, what I should be doing, to become a better comedian or whatever. And actually, I honestly think the one thing is just like, is that you follow your own instincts and you just, Josie Long told me early doors, just try out everything while no one can judge you. And that's still the best bit of advice I've ever been given. And just do that. Just like try everything out. Be honest with yourself whether it works, and then just you'll develop your own instinct so that down the line, whenever people try and steer you in other directions, I've had other comics, promoters and people like that try and be like, you should be doing this, when you've just bombed at a club night or whatever it is, or at a festival, or I've bombed everywhere, but people then try afterwards to tell you this is what you should be doing, that you can go, no, it's not. You can think to yourself, at least, not to say it to their face, but that's not what I should be doing, because I follow my instinct from the start, and I know that I'm gonna go in loads of potholes along the way, but this is what this direction is the direction I should be going in.
James Agasser, excellent stuff. Thank you for joining me for your first gig.
No worries, man.
That's it. There we go. In the can. Episode 1 done. We're on the roll. Next Wednesday, episode 2. If you like this episode, please, please, please get in touch. Obviously, do all the usual stuff. Subscribe, leave a review, tell your friends, follow on social media at MyFirstGigPod across all social media. But, am I just shouting out into the abyss right now? Are you there? Did you listen? Did you enjoy it? If so, head on over to Twitter, to Instagram, to Facebook and send a message. Just say that you enjoyed it. Maybe share it and encourage somebody else to listen in. Let's just prove that we're not all doing this for nothing. Do you exist? If you want to exist, prove it. Prove it to the world and say, I exist and I listen to podcasts and you should too. Otherwise, never mind what I'm doing with my life. What are you doing with your life if you're not sharing My First Gig? But sincerely, thank you so much for joining me here on the first outing of My First Gig. Cannot wait to bring you episode 2. Guest will be revealed shortly on the internet. That's how it works, isn't it? Yes. Check out Facebook, check out Twitter, check out Instagram for guest 2 ahead of next Wednesday. If you subscribe, you might even get it before anybody else. Oh, bragging rights when you head into school in the morning. But actually, if you're heading into school and you're listening to this, then maybe I've missed my target demographic. Look, wherever you're going, subscribe, enjoy, see you next week. Thank you so much for joining. I'm Dwayne Dugan. Follow me at Dwayne Dugan. Follow this podcast at My First Gig Pod. Thank you so much for joining for episode 1. We'll see you for episode 2. Goodbye.
It's the My First Gig Podcast. Whoa.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.